ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Let's talk about confidentiality. That's the title of a significant new research report focusing on how lawyers use non-disclosure agreements in sexual harassment settlements. You'll hear about it first right here on The Law Report. Hi, Damien Carrick with you. The first media interview with the report authors is coming up shortly.
So I was stalked for about 3 years in my workplace. It was an all-male workplace, so I felt very isolated. The guys couldn't understand why it was so scary.
Let's hear from a woman known as Rachel, not her real name, who decided that her best option was to sign a non-disclosure agreement.
It was intimidation, stalking, a lot of resistance to bringing up the issue. My job was threatened when I was told if I didn't stop complaining, it wouldn't end well for me. When eventually an acting manager came in and did an investigation, at least they did an investigation, but it was just to cover the legal side, not the duty of care. So they could only prove a few counts of what had been happened. So I had to either work with this person or take a small payout and go immediately.
You chose to sign a non-disclosure agreement as part of the settlement. What information did the agreement prevent you from disclosing?
I couldn't tarnish the name of the company or anyone at the company, so I couldn't share my story. So if another woman went to work there, they would be in the same atmosphere and environment and open to the same behaviour. When I went to get a new job, I couldn't say why I was leaving my old job. It made it feel like it was my fault and my issue. I felt very silenced.
Did you have any carve-outs so you were able to talk to, say, counsellors or family or close friends about it? You just weren't able to talk about it publicly?
I wasn't allowed to talk about it really to anyone, but I talked to a counsellor about it and I talked to my close friends about it. To process it really, yeah.
And you had support from your union and also support and advice from an employment lawyer. What did they advise you with respect to the non-disclosure agreement?
The unions were great, so I'd always be a member of a union. They were very supportive, but they recommended I sign it and take the money and leave too, because these sort of things happen all the time, and that's what the employment lawyer said. Really, just these things happen all the time, and take the money and to reset and go. It wasn't a lot of money, and I didn't have another job secured, so I had to. That might have had to support me for months and months, and it wasn't a lot of money, so it was a really scary time.
How do you feel about the non-disclosure agreement?
I think it's terrible because the companies still look like a good corporate citizen, but they're not actioning any of the toxic environment they've got in the workplace. It's affected my health and well-being, and any women that would work there would feel the same. It's a cover-up, and it's making the victim feel like they're the problem and just trying to go on as normal. They're not trying to fix anything. Yeah, it removes accountability for the employer.
Do you know if your co-workers' behaviours were ever addressed or the wider environment in which it took place were ever addressed?
Not to my knowledge, no. They've got to keep on going with their job and with all the benefits in that company and no disruption.
Rachel, not her real name. Victorian Trades Hall Council has for a long time been campaigning for legislation to prohibit NDAs in sexual harassment claims. Will Strack, an Assistant Secretary with Victorian Trades Hall Council, says these agreements allow toxic workplace cultures to continue, which puts more workers at risk. And she also warns that they are very harmful to workers like Rachel, who sign away their ability to speak openly about their experience.
The evidence tells us they're incredibly harmful for those who sign them. We know that the regret kicks in most commonly around 6 months after someone signs up, once the kind of immediate trauma of what's happened is done, and it lasts a lifetime. And so lots of people have told us in their experiences that they wish that they had never signed them, that in fact, it would have been better for them if they'd gone to court. It would have been better for them if the whole thing had been out in the open. It might have been difficult in the time, but in the long run, that would have been better for them.
I understand that some lawyers tell their clients, look, you can actually get a bigger settlement if you agree to a non-disclosure agreement. That's what's on the table here. That's the bargain, right?
That's what they say, but I don't actually believe that. In America, they introduced legislation in California that said that they could no longer have these non-disclosure agreements, and settlement sums haven't gone down and settlement rates haven't gone down. Generally, what employers offer as a settlement, it's not for silence. It's to avoid the inconvenience of having to go to court and all of the added expenditure that goes with that. That's why corporations settle these things. The silence component is just the added bonus that they get to leverage. The second thing I'd say about that is workers should be compensated for what has happened to them. But when you start adding money in to buy silence, is that actually compensation or what is that? Actually, what does that look like? It looks pretty off to me. So, A, I don't believe it. I don't believe that if we introduce legislation to get rid of these things, that companies will not settle these matters. And B, I don't know what we're compensating people for when we start buying silence.
Are there arguments that employers or organisations, provided that they do actually commit to addressing the issues, a non-disclosure agreement does allow everybody to move forward and address the issues?
The point is that they don't address the issues. We've had decades of these things and organisations haven't done that. Look, I'm a union official. I have sat with members and told them, we've got to settle this for you to move on. It's good for your mental health to move on. Let's just settle this in whatever way we can. There's this non-disclosure agreement. But now I would never do that. I know now the harm that these things cause. And I also know that the harm they cause to organisations, because there's no incentive for organisations to fix these things. They make these commitments, but if no one can ever talk about it, then who's to hold them to a commitment to make those changes? We need to see the sunlight on these things. We need them to be out in the open so that everyone is actually accountable for what's happened and for what we need to do to fix it.
Will Strachan, Assistant Secretary with the Victorian Trades Hall Council. Lawyer Shamila Bargan runs the employment law practice at the Redfern Legal Centre, and her former colleague, lawyer Regina Featherstone, who now works with the Whistleblower Project at the Human Rights Law Centre, together have a huge amount of experience representing applicants in sexual harassment cases. They felt that there was a strong need to better understand what their colleagues in the legal profession, lawyers who act for either workers or employers, think about NDAs, and whether or not they had taken on board the guidelines arising out of the Australian Human Rights Commission 2020 Respect at Work report. This is their first media interview about their research report, which is titled Let's Talk About Confidentiality. Shamila Bargan, if I can start with you, why did you both decide to survey 145 of your colleagues?
The whole purpose of NDAs is silence. So we wanted to investigate, following the Respect at Work's findings, that NDAs can be misused and can be problematic. And following the Respect at Work Council issuing guidelines, indicating how NDAs should be used and not misused, we wanted to see the impact on the profession. We wanted to investigate practitioners and how they use NDAs in resolving these kinds of matters.
So the way it works is a complaint is made and then there might be negotiation between the employer and the employee. If that doesn't work, then a complaint might be lodged with the Australian Human Rights Commission, and then there's kind of mandatory conciliation. And then if that doesn't work, you can end up in court. But very few cases actually get determined by a judge in a courtroom. So you're trying to work out how these non-disclosure agreements work at every stage before you get to a courtroom or to a trial. What did you find in your research? Or what did people say about NDAs? How prevalent are they? Regina Featherstone.
Our research found that 75% of legal practitioners working in sexual harassment matters have never settled a matter without a strict non-disclosure agreement. That's really significant because that means that they've never settled a matter without blanket confidentiality. That means there's no exceptions for the victim survivor to be able to talk to friends, family, medical support. And that's really significant because we have had Me Too, we've had the Respect at Work report, and we've had these guidelines. And so 10 months into these guidelines being issued, we have only 25% of practitioners who say that they have actually been successful in securing settlements without these very strict, exhaustive NDAs.
Okay, so what are the consequences, or what can be the consequences of a non-disclosure agreement? What's been your experience as practitioners in this field?
The consequences of signing a non-disclosure agreement are huge. For somebody who has experienced what we know is obviously a traumatic incident or multiple incidences, it means they can't speak to anybody. It means that their journey towards healing is significantly impacted and impaired by this decision to sign a non-disclosure agreement. And our experience as practitioners is that even though we had Respect at Work, even though we had all of these changes happening at this legal level, at this cultural level, what we found when we were negotiating with other sides and trying to resolve these matters was that it was so difficult to even budge on simple carve-outs to have our clients, the victim-survivor clients, be able to speak to, you know, a doctor. And we really saw that it was a form of power and control that was still being utilised in the NDA negotiations.
So what are the advantages and disadvantages for each party from a non-disclosure agreement? And it's not binary in the sense that it's not just applicants or complainants who never want them and employers who always want them. What are the advantages for both sides? Shamila Bargan.
So it's really multifaceted, and it's really important for us to stage this research in that we're not saying NDAs are bad. We're absolutely not saying that. In our experience as practitioners, time and time again, clients will tell us that they want NDAs. They want to utilise some form of NDA to potentially protect their professional reputation. But the issue that we were experiencing is that the blanket application of strict NDAs, and by strict I mean exhaustive NDAs that aren't time capped, really shut down debate. So when you're trying to negotiate with someone, we found in our professional, personal experience that sometimes it was like an education piece. We had to educate respondent lawyers on the other side that damages in this area are increasing. We had to talk to them about the ways that NDAs are being used and can be used in terms of having exceptions for applicants to be able to talk to this, the support people, having time caps, having all sorts of variations than blanket strict NDAs. And when you're in a negotiation and you have to send cases through to the other side to educate them about the way that practice is moving, it's really tiring. And when you're dealing with clients like ours, who maybe only have so much fight in them, it can be that confidentiality will be one of the things very quickly taken off the table in terms of active negotiation.
So presumably the employer lawyers want or ask for non-disclosure agreements because employers don't and businesses don't want this out in the public domain. They want to keep the reputation of their firm and maybe of their sort of, you know, high-level people in the firm. And that's what's in it for them. That's why they want to keep this under wraps.
You're entirely right, Damien, that is a reason that a lot of respondents put forward.
In your research, you surveyed these lawyers. There were some fascinating comments made. One of the lawyers for complainants said, "One case I settled, I could have got her $25,000, I think, with no non-disclosure agreement. $1 million with a non-disclosure agreement. Oh, absolutely, that's what they're buying. There's no doubt about that. There's always an extra naught before the comma if it's going to be confidential. So the lawyers for the complainant see it as in the best interest of their client because they can achieve a much, much higher settlement for the complaint. Regina Featherstone.
I think that that's right. Those quotes that we were able to get out of the interviews with solicitors, it's really telling because there's so much divergence in the legal profession on this. That quote that you just read out is really significant because it pins the monetary figure or the monetary outcome as the only goal in a settlement. And that is certainly a significant factor. But what we also learned from a lot of solicitors speaking to their client experience is that clients also want to have preventative functions in their settlements where they can advocate on this issue or where the issue can be known about the perpetrator having sexually harassed one person so that they may not sexually harass others. What we've found in our research is that 30% of applicant solicitors and 50% of respondent solicitors say that they do not advise clients that non-disclosure agreements in sexual harassment settlements are an optional term. Now, that's really significant because they're making the decision in that instance that the only outcome is monetary, that the settlement is conditional on a really significant outcome, and that may be as well because solicitors want to receive money, you know, they're charging for their fees, and so there may be an interest there. But really critically, we have really strict professional legal obligations. Solicitors give advice, clients instruct. It's pretty simple. But if you aren't giving that advice to a client, you're actually taking away their power and their ability to advocate for themselves on what is actually right for them.
That's really the big take-home message from this research, that complainants and maybe even employers are not actually being given a choice here. They're not actually being informed by their own lawyers that NDAs are an option. It's become, if you like, the default setting for these sorts of negotiations, and not enough people are being told about what the options are.
It's really significant. That is a takeaway from our research that we were quite struck by. Why that's significant is because we have solicitors who do provide advice on the optional clauses of NDAs and the different variations that non-disclosure agreements can have, like as imagined in the NDA guidelines. But what we have is solicitors who are advocating on this. They do so regularly and they achieve settlements without strict NDAs.
So what are the possible outcomes which people want if they know that the option is available and maybe some of your clients have asked for and obtained? Shamila Bargan.
So it's very, very standard that people want to talk to their supports. They've gone through something hard. It's pretty normal to want to debrief. And so sometimes people will want to name their partner, their, you know, their friends and family. And so that's a very typical request that we see. And it's so typical that some solicitors, practitioners that we surveyed were actually indicating that that was what they considered to be standard practice, which is, it's really interesting. But some other things that people were seeking is a time cap on the confidentiality. So letting someone talk about the matter after a certain period has expired. Sometimes this will be after they've left employment. They might have worked at any number of employers since, and then they were open to talk about it.
So the idea is that sometimes employees want to be able to find new employment, move on without the controversy surrounding or the controversy or the talk around the sexual harassment complaint. And so that suits their purposes. But others presumably would want to talk immediately about their experience and maybe alert other people about what they might regard as a perpetrator or a systemic cultural problem in an organisation.
And some confidentiality agreements can allow exactly that, but maybe they are asked to keep the actual amount, the settlement sum, silent. Some will be asked to keep the more broad terms of the settlement silent, but they can actually talk about the incident themselves.
I think one of the things that we learned is that there's really no cohesive practice in the profession. And that's because of the very nature of NDAs that nobody, we can't talk about it, but also maybe because it hasn't really been addressed by the profession until pretty recently. So We had a lot of solicitors tell us that standard practice is that they always ask for carve-outs for medical practitioners or friends or family, and that those friends or family may also be asked to sign a confidentiality agreement. Other solicitors told us that the standard around confidentiality is that the settlement terms are confidential only, as Sharmila just said, that they could speak to the incidences and not prevent that healing journey in that way. But we also had a lot of solicitors who say that their experience is that the standard is that strict NDAs, where the victim survivor cannot speak to anybody at all in perpetuity, remain the standard. So we had all of these different approaches, but we were told by all of the solicitors that this is standard practice. But because we actually don't talk about it, because we don't share this information, and up until now there's been no data on it, there is no such thing as standard. So we were really surprised to learn that in the profession. I think everyone thinks like them or does practice like their firm does, but certainly there was no one cohesive approach to NDAs in the sector.
Damien Carrick with you today on the Law Report, conversation with lawyers Regina Featherstone and Sharmila Bargan, who are the joint authors of new research looking at non-disclosure agreements in sexual harassment settlements. The name of the report is called Let's Talk About Confidentiality. Let's now focus on the regulatory and maybe legislative framework, which might be the best way of tackling or dealing with this issue. So we had the Respect at Work report, I think, in late 2022, issuing a set of guidelines about how the Australian Human Rights Commission Respect at Work report, and it issued a set of guidelines for non-disclosure agreements. What are in those guidelines, and have they been adopted, and do you think that's the best approach? Regina Featherstone.
So the guidelines have six clauses or six standards that they expect practitioners to really abide by and factor in when they're settling out-of-court sexual harassment matters in relation to the workplace. The first guideline that we have is that non-disclosure agreements should be used on a case-by-case basis. They shouldn't be the standard. And then from there, there's a series of guidelines that really look at how we can diminish the scope to allow more freedom and provide for less restrictive confidentiality agreements. What we wanted to research was whether the guidelines are actually known and read and utilised by the profession. Our research showed that 3/4 of the profession have read the guidelines. There's a small percentage who didn't even know they existed. But really, a lot of our research pointed to the fact that the guidelines aren't used in settlement practices. You know, they're not being provided as an active tool in settlement negotiations.
We have these NDAs. What happens if somebody breaks an NDA? What happens if somebody speaks out in contravention of a non-disclosure agreement?
We weren't able to find any case law on that, and I think that that's really significant, and that really points to the whole point of our research is that why would somebody speak out and risk potentially being sued for a breach of contract? And it's not even actually legal proceedings being commenced. It would even be a letter, a cease and desist, or a letter of demand to a victim survivor saying, hey, you've breached this term. Whether or not that would be enforceable, it would have to be for a court to determine.
Have you ever seen those letters of concern?
What we have seen, certainly in both Sharmila and my practice, and this was also echoed across the board from applicant lawyers in our research, were that many solicitors said that they had clients who received concerns notices, and those concerns notices relate to the threats of a defamation. So the Respect at Work report said that defamation has had a chilling effect on sexual harassment progress in Australia. We had solicitors telling us of victim survivors who have made internal complaints to their HR or to the franchise body that they had experienced sexual harassment, and the alleged perpetrator was slapping a concerns notice saying that there's been defamatory imputations published against them and that they should stop, and otherwise they may be going to court.
So that's slightly distinct from this issue of non-disclosure agreements, but it goes to the whole issue of we're not actually having kind of open and frank and safe conversations about sexual harassment when we need to be.
I think that that's right.
In conclusion, What do you want to see happen in this space? How do you want the information that you have found through your research used? Do you want legislation, or do you want some other form of regulation, or is it just about legal education? What do you think is the best way forward? I'll hear from both of you, but Shamila Bargan?
So we don't think that legislation is the core goal. There are so many moving parts, and we all as solicitors and barristers and practitioners can do something about this and make change now. So a core part of our research was that if advocates actively engage with this issue, they can get results. So we're really interested in talking to the profession, legal education as a key point, but also a thing that people told us time and time again was model clauses. So moving away from standard practice and that, you know, 20-year precedent that's been floating around in a firm, and actually engaging with the issue afresh and considering alternatives and introducing nuance by the use of model clauses. So we have drafted model clauses that will be available with our report, and the purpose of them is to for them to be used. So we would love the practitioners trying to settle cases in this kind of matter to pick them up if they're worried about having to draft from scratch, which was an issue that many solicitors told us they were worried about, drafting something from scratch or drafting novel content because it might not fit in align with their firm's policy. There's a number of things that can be done. And another really interesting area I think that we can also look at is to engage with corporates. And by engaging with corporate social responsibility obligations and framing this as an environmental, social and governance issue. So there's so much that can be done in addition to working towards legislative reform.
Ultimately, what we want is to have these, you know, basically tomorrow a solicitor could have heard this, be in negotiations and implement some of this change. Legislative reform is certainly one way that that could happen, but we want the profession to sort of consider this issue tomorrow if they were resolving a matter and make that change and benefit their client in that way immediately.
We need to get onto this now. That's, I think, a great place to leave the conversation. Lawyer Regina Featherstone, who now works with the Whistleblower Project at the Human Rights Law Centre, but formerly at the Redfern Legal Centre, and Lawyer Shamila Bargan, who runs the employment law practice at the Redfern Legal Centre. Thank you both for speaking to the Law Report.
Thanks so much for your time, Damien.
Thank you, Damien.
And their report, Let's Talk About Confidentiality, is available online at the Redfern Community Legal Centre website. That's all we have time for today. A big thank you to producer Christina Cucoglia and also to sound engineer Tim Jenkins. Next time on The Law Report, we'll speak with Canadian academic and activist Julie McFarlane. She's co-founder of the Can't Buy My Silence campaign, and she has an incredible story to tell about what happens when people speak out about sexual harassment. You can follow The Law Report on the ABC Listen app. And if you find us on other podcast platforms, please do leave us a review or maybe a like. It helps others find the program. I'm Damien Carrick. Until next time.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.